Karen Tolmonte and Claire and David Rennie and others are up. So Karen, you're up first. You'll need a microphone, and then Claire Duffy.
Well, again, thank you so much. And how extraordinary that in the space of 24 hours, we've gone from John Winthrop to Joel Osteen without getting carsick. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on Sarah and the question of how this touches policy. So in the prosperity gospel view of the world, what's the role of government?
I think it's ambivalent. For the most part, theologically, the theological infrastructure of the prosperity gospel does not require good government. And so, but it's also been led by preachers who had no access to it. And so a lot of its aspirational language can be read as an explanation for its distance from it. I haven't studied the Brazilian or Nigerian iterations, but I imagine that they may. It might pivot very well as both an indictment of corrupt structures, working in favor of the kind of self-made story that every politician uses. So I imagine that it would be politically weaponized quite easily. But for the most part, in all the sermons I've heard, they're trying to inspire righteous individualism. And so sometimes there'll be topics that infringe upon that, but they're, like she mentioned, Israel. I've only ever seen that in those who have strong Zionist tendencies that are more like a side dish, but I've rarely seen them integrated.
So they can kind of latch on to a Donald Trump figure who's obviously been anointed by God because he's rich without latching on to any of the things that he says he wants to do?
So I struggle a little bit with understanding exactly how expectation about Donald Trump fits into the kind of the imagination that he cultivates, because he embodies and describes a world in which every individual can make it in America with a little theological help. On the other hand, he came to power as an indictment of the corruption that says that no one can make it in America. So sometimes I wonder if it's part of the relationship that if Trump to the American people with this kind of prosperity imagination will be somewhat similar to a prosperity preacher in his congregation, in which he will always have the things that they don't have, but will serve as an aspirational figure. The proximity to him will be a reminder that it could be possible, even if mostly what the pastor is doing is telling them to wait.
Claire Duffy.
Thanks, Kate. I just had two questions. The first is just, would any of the mega churches that you studied object to being called prosperity?
Yeah.
I mean, is it a term that is they see as pejorative?
Super, and yes.
Okay.
It was horrible. Yes. This was the 10 to 15 minutes at the beginning of every interview. Like, why are you here? Secretly, I have identified you as a prosperity church. Out loud. I have noticed that you have a message of faith, health, wealth, and victory that blah, blah, blah. Also, you're best friends with, you know, these five people. Again, why did you choose this church? So that became the worst part of this study, and then the fixation on creating all the appendices to try to offer supplemental. But it is pejorative. And I think, I mean, someone raised this as the Emma's point about the worry of condescension, right? And right now, of course, and I am always a perpetrator of this, is that condescension is such an easy time for that right now when the claims can be so absurd. But part of what fuels it is its absurdity, that in the course of a human life, this can be fixed. Nothing is broken. Nothing is lost, right? It's like just the flip side of something very beautiful that can be rendered so terrible, both in the words we use to describe it and in the people we see as the victims of it. So I struggled a lot with the naming rhetoric, and also, like, when you were describing your interview, where you, like, are you a heretic? Like, I've never heard anyone under any conditions say, this is definitely heresy. Like, I have accepted a derivation on Christian orthodoxy. So much of it...
What would they like to be called? In other words, if they don't want to be called prosecutor, well, do they have a way of...
There's a kind of thin... there was the tradition that came out of Rima Bible, and they were comfortable with being called Word of Faith. I tried hard
word
to say
faith
preachers for a long time, and I realized no one used it, and publishers thought it was lame. And then, but non-denominational Pentecostal was, but the Pentecostals were like, but most of us aren't like that. So it became, so I just had to bite the bullet and use it, even though I'd like to just suggest that it be used to describe kind of an orientation or sometimes a language that people use and then discard. So you might look through my appendix and think, well, that person didn't sound like one when they talked to me. And sometimes it'll be a way they talk to their a certain congregation or conference. And sometimes it's a language they take on, especially during a building campaign, because most Christians lack language to fundraise, frankly, and they wanted, so it became a kind of borrowing. It's a rhetorical expression. But for the most part, it should be a term used lightly, I think.
And my other question is quite a bit bigger, and I guess I should have read Van's article in The Atlantic before asking this, but how do you see, even if it is not explicitly prosperity gospel or its influence, but whatever it reflects in the American character or, you know, view towards inequality and, yeah, you know, misfortune befalling others, how do you see that influencing the healthcare debate right now?
Right. Well, I think one of its much more disturbing results is it the way it it allows people a language by which to justify inequality, because righteous individuals can always make it. It also, I think, part of the work of being in the movement is also its advantage. It helps inure people to the exhaustion of constant risk. So oddly enough, it might make the same people that it is pulling benefits from feel more comfortable with the growing disparity in the country between those who can afford the very best and those who can't. I mean, the people with pre-existing conditions. So I wrote one piece on how it's not just that the prosperity gospel's approach to health is purely supernatural. A lot of the people that I spent time with in that ethnographic study that I did were nurses at Duke University Hospital, and they would often use faith teaching for certain things, and then with others, they would just go to the doctor, and then they would get a diagnosis, and then sometimes they just hop off the table and decide they're going to take care of it spiritually. So it was always a both and. People use their institutions as well as they might say that Jesus is the best physician. So we'll find people pivoting back and forth as they make sense of the resources that are available to them.
David Rennie, you're up next, David, and then Sally.
In terms of numbers, what you talked about the numbers of churches and things, but how many Americans do you think actually routinely attend these churches?
Because none. So I have now convinced National Congregation Surveys to add my questions to their surveys, so I will have an answer for you in 4 years. But there are some good, Time did a good survey a few years ago that tried to drill down on how many of you go to a church that professes that faith is rewarded and health, some version of it. The answer was about 38%, I think, with that study. The thing is, I can only count mega churches, and with the increase in concentration, as I mentioned, of people in big churches, it's not a bad count, but I can't get a sense of all the very small churches. It's millions. How many millions? I do not know.
But not all mega churches are prosperity gospel churches.
No, just 40% of the big ones, and then lots of...
Go ahead.
But just, sorry to follow, because I'm very literal-minded.
Yeah.
Is it your kind of hunch, if there is a link to Trump getting elected, that this language is out there in the ether and he has over time learned how to use it effectively in a kind of distinctively American way, or he is saying things in a way that directly speaks to enough people that it has a kind of an electoral impact?
Well, and to further complicate your helpful first question, I don't know if there's a relationship between the number of people who believe that God rewards people with health and wealth as those who actually attend those churches, or if it's something that they get from Oprah, right? So it is so much a part of the water everyone's swimming in that naming numbers in terms of congregational attendance is going to be really tough. Do I think that it created some of the cultural and ideological preconditions that help make sense of a person like Trump? Absolutely. Do I think that helps give people a greater sense, greater comfort with a fickle market and an ideologue who can help control it? Yes, absolutely. I have no idea, though, whether that could map as easily onto congregational attendances, I would like.
Sally? Sally Quinn.
Yeah, I have, of course, 1,000 questions, but Michael wouldn't like that, so. I'm really interested in the idea of the contradiction between luck and blessed, because there is something, blessed sort of has an edge of hubris to it, and it doesn't, you know, pride is one of the 7 deadly sins, and blessed, which, by the way, is a word that has caught on. I mean, I find that I hear people always saying, oh, well, I'm blessed I found a good apartment, or I'm blessed, you know, we got a weekend at the beach. It's become very sort of trite. I'm blessed to be at the Faith Angle Forum. Exactly. what I'm trying to figure out is that, so you're blessed and you don't believe in luck, but what do you say to the family who's driving down the highway and their car gets hit and all 5 of their children are killed?
Yeah, yeah.
Are they blessed? I mean, where did they go with that? That's my first question.
Yeah.
The thing between luck, because I believe in luck. Mm-hmm. I'm lucky to be at the Faith Angle Forum.
Yes.
And the other question is.
And you're blessed.
And blessed. You haven't mentioned your cancer and your feelings about that and your spiritual feelings about that and where you stand on the subject of prosperity, health, wealth, and how that has affected you emotionally and psychologically. And you said earlier that you were conflicted and that you sometimes got defensive about the whole prosperity gospel thing. So yeah. I'd really like if you could answer the question about blessed
sure.
versus luck, and then talk about your cancer.
Sure. Well, I think you're right that blessed is a really loaded term that, as I wrote in that piece that you were all so lovingly forced to read, thank you so much, that it connotes gift but also reward. And that people use it in a way that suggests that they put themselves in the right place at the right time. I think it is, and it's incredibly natural for us all to hope that all of our small efforts are amounting to something. So I think it's a very human impulse to want to pat ourselves on the back at the same time as we're pretending that we're also giving the pointy finger. But it has become, I think, an expression of the prosperity gospel's cultural influence that we are combing through our own biographies to look for evidence of our divine good fortune and also the fruit of all the hard work we put in. So I think that also expresses the ambivalence I have. So I come from a Mennonite background. I was initially horrified. I think it's the right word, by the prosperity gospel. I saw it with that kind of car accident curiosity that I think many people have when they approach a movement that seems foreign and slightly abhorrent. And then the more time I spent with its believers, the more I became deeply sympathetic to the way that they're all trying to run that spiritual math. How do I know if my life is getting better? How do I know if the work I'm putting in is going to make my kids happy and strengthen my marriage? And I saw that they were being taught a spiritual math and a way to track in a way that was deeply attractive, not just to them, but I think most of my middle-class friends who all want to think, at least in my subset, that education and our general scrappiness was amounting to something. So that's partly why I wrote that memoir, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved, is I was trying to grapple with how much I have loved those myths of self-improvement. And I don't know, I think I always thought, and I realize this is just an expression of me being middle class, as I thought that my scrappy personality was unique to who I am and is probably just a product of education and a general sense that things were going to work out. And then all of a sudden, when the rug got pulled out from underneath me, I think I realized I had much more in common with the people I was studying than I realized. So I've tried to translate that ambivalence into a kind of compassion for the fragility that I think we are all experiencing. So we just try to keep our lives, not put our lives together, just keep our lives together. And I hope that kind of, though at the same time, I'm saddened by the kind of individualism that always makes me a problem to be solved. I mean, the world is not safe for me anymore. And it's one of the hardest things about being sick, is that everyone wants to explain my suffering. And I wish they would just learn to be present. So it's a kind of both and. Yeah.
Okay. Eugene Scott, do you already have your intervention, or?
I have a few questions, but I'll ask the one that is not.
So okay. Why don't you pull the mic over and turn the light on?
So I grew up in Black Baptist churches, which are perhaps inherently somewhat charismatic, but
were you Bapticostal or just Baptist?
Bapticostal would definitely be the term we would use. Okay. And so, just to show legitimacy to the term, the denomination that my family is a part of is called the Full Gospel Baptist Church, which is based in New Orleans, which is a Baptist denomination that was started by a Pentecostal pastor. So it's literally Bapticostal.
It's real.
Most of the criticism I was exposed to of the prosperity gospel came when I became more visible in reformed white evangelical circles. And I've seen lots of columns and op-eds about what's wrong with the prosperity gospel. I have not seen much self-reflection about what role that these faith communities play in creating the prosperity gospel, because I tend to think of the prosperity gospel as a response to some maybe vacancies or weaknesses that some of these people saw in more mainline traditions, more reformed, less expressive, emotional traditions. And I didn't know if you had seen anything like that, opposed to, literally, I read a column literally yesterday by Tim Challies about what's wrong with T.D. Jakes, opposed to, I have yet to read a column about why does T.D. Jakes exist, and what role did we play in it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think.
And
that's,
John Piper has written a strong critique of the prosperity.
Oh my gosh! Yes.
Just thought I'd mention.
Yeah, and I think it's everyone's favorite whipping boy for greedy capitalists. And when in truth, you know, I go to a church with more money in its organ and in its stained glass than it does in its rose garden and the upkeep of its cemeteries than it does in outreach programs.
Right.
So. A hearty yes to your observation. I do think Full Gospel is an example of a market-dominant denomination who has used that bilingualism, structural solutions, very community and civic-minded, at the same time as very high-flying prosperity gospel into a single denomination. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's tremendous energy around those kinds of pairings, because it is exempt from the critique that it's just bald capitalism. Right. It is trying to take and then transform, not just themselves, but its leaders. It does mimic a lot of the same lack of transparency, though, in some of the worst. Mm-hmm. But there's been some scandals that have been, I think, largely put aside right now. But they struggle from the same kinds of imbalances as most other big churches, lack of accountability, family dynasties, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the impulse is incredibly honest, and I think that's exactly the right question, not who but why.
Yeah,
it's an indictment. It's on us all. Yeah.
Dole, once you get the microphone up, you're next. And will you tell us what church it was where the pastor almost choked on the fog machine?
So I wrote that little thing about like this guy almost dying on his own fog machine, and I just kept it really vague. I got so many confession letters about that. People writing me constant emails to say it was me. I turned it up. It was my last Sunday, and I just couldn't take it anymore. So 4 or 5 churches I got. So it wasn't any of them, weirdly enough, that I got confessions from. It was from this little denomination in the International Pentecostal Holiness Church. It was this little mountain denomination in rural North Carolina. And then it became this, had one market-dominant megachurch, Ron Carpenter Jr. So Ron Carpenter Sr. was the sort of formally attired Pentecostal leader. And I watched the video of his ceremony in which he said, they Elijah to Elisha'd it, basically, where it was like, I must decrease. He said, Ron Sr. must decrease, that Ron Jr. might increase. And then Ron Carpenter Jr. almost choked to death on the fog machine I was there at, to this thumping bass beat. And I've like to say that I felt compassion. I was just going to rush to the front, but I just needed a minute. I was like, what is happening?
Where is that in North Carolina again?
That one is in South Carolina, the large church. It's in Greenville.
I want to visit.
It says it's 10,000. We'll see.
Well, we're blessed that he survived the incident.
He sure did.
That would have been difficult to explain. I have two questions. First is you in the top of your talk, you touched very briefly on the question of explicit political engagement, electoral engagement. Yeah. Some preachers endorse, others don't. I'd like you to talk a little more about the phenomenon, the taxonomy of that. Is there an explicit debate over engagement or separationism of the kind that has, of course, been roiling evangelicals forever? So that's question one. And then question two is, observation, we've seen Faith at work here today because I think you've probably sold 2 dozen copies of your book.
$12. Yeah. Oh, 24. Thank you.
But that book is 5 whole years old, which is a real long time. And so to fill in our reading time between after we finish reading Blessed and your new book coming out, where can we find examples of your work and this conversation in the months intervening?
Well, because most of my stuff, because I'm trying to get and keep my job, goes to academic journals. and so I put it on my academia.edu website, and then I just tweeted it out to you all. So you can see uploaded versions of things I wrote on. It's like a religious history major tries to understand the economy. A religious history person tries to understand politics. So there's a little of that. But it shows stuff that might be useful to you all is the bilingualism people seem to have when they think about their own healthcare, bilingualism, like the supernatural plus structural.
Excuse me, her blog is amazing. I devoured it last night.
Thanks, Karen.
And she's at Kate C. Bowler.
Thank you. Aw, thanks.
So what is the blog? How do we get to it?
KateBowler.com.
Say it again.
KateBowler.com.
Okay.
C'est moi.
The Jimmy Carter entry alone is incredible.
Thank you, Karen. There's a lot of my reflections on the prosperity gospel from chemo chairs. So it's a lot of the feelings side. If you want some feelings, there's a lot of feelings there. But the academic side, I tweeted to you all so you can get any uploads if that stuff's helpful. Also, and I really mean that as an invitation, most of the stuff I want to do is just to be a resource. So if there's a person you're studying and you just want a quick thing, I'm really happy to just try to get back to you as fast as possible and give you what I have. On the matter of policy, this is the stuff I'm the weakest at, to be honest, so I only have impressions and not conclusions. I did a study of the largest Latino megachurches, period, in the country to figure out which ones were Pentecostal, which were prosperity, and which were mainline. A lot of it actually was inspired by the time piece that Elizabeth did a while ago on Latino Protestants, and found that among the Latino prosperity churches in South Florida, they were the most oddly hard prosperity and most politically vigorous. So they, I only slightly understood Florida Republicans.
But, are they disproportionately Cuban or not?
Yeah, so there's a high percentage of, but they're, you have to think of those churches as being the northernmost tip of a global southern reach. And so they're echoing Latin American politics at the same time as they're translating into an American context.
So it could like be Guatemala too.
That's right, yeah. So Cash Luna from Guatemala does show up a lot. And then they dance. It's like amazing video. You really should watch the El Rey church in Miami. I'm happy just also to provide a list of Latino megachurches. So they're much more actively Republican than I expected and seem to host political candidates, though they said they weren't endorsing them. There seems to be a hub of African-American Republican that has a political currency around the Word of Faith Church in Detroit, and that seems like a real hub. And then in California, most of those megachurches that were black were Democrats by instinct. So I really couldn't track any kind of circuit of politicians among them. Because they didn't publicize it, and I could never get it on conference advertisements. So to be honest, unless I showed up and they were there that day, I really struggled to actually map their circuits.
But at least anecdotally and from the content of the preaching, it sounds like it is the exception rather than the rule, and that it's not a central part.
Yeah, at least in the it's largely those therapeutic ministrations in which it's righteous individuals and changing of one's mind.
Okay, A.B. Stoddard, you're up.
Here we go. Hey, thank you. It's been staggering, actually. Really wonderful. I feel greedy taking up too much time because everyone has so many questions. I wanted you to just touch briefly on this spiritual math, whatever these metrics are, for acting faith and for feeling, I guess, you know, because it's rooted in the power of positive thinking, that you have to go through your day, no matter how you feel or what bills you're trying to pay, seeing everything as achieved, right?
Yes.
But there's a finality of victory, which you didn't spend too much time on, that seems so incongruous because mm-hmm. it's just a waiting game. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it sounds derisive to say that, but it is a faith of waiting it out. So what is victory, and what happens to those in the church who achieve victory, and then how is it measured, and how is it received among the group?
Well, I mean, that's exactly right, is the language of victory ends up being more of an orientation than an accomplishment, because every time something is achieved, like for a church, for example, the most important communal church activity of victory is in a building expansion. And so at the center of the foyer, they'll have like a usually a little, you know, architect, little man trees, tiny buildings that they can all look at for years as they think about donations and all kinds of ritualizing of excitement around expansion and all the souls that will be saved. And so if you just want to look at an example of how they do their metrics, like their language of victorious metrics, is always in the pastor's bio about the church. Now it's all video, it used to be, but like it was one man and a living room and eight people. And then it shows that by numbers, it's always in numbers, it will show the ascent. And then usually just a video montage of expanding buildings and then the crowds. The most important public expression of victory is the crowd, is their hands in the air, the person beside. You know, it's the expression of influence, which is why American prosperity preachers have always needed African, in particular, audiences. There has to be a reciprocity between the power of American preachers, and then the largest crusades in the world are almost always in Africa. And so they'll see like them in front of, you know, a million people is the most powerful confirmation of their influence. And so crowds that megachurches have institutionalized revivalism. It's the biggest number of people, but the people echoing back is the greatest expression of God having arrived. and souls having been saved, et cetera, et cetera. So what happens when it's in an individual life, though, it's much harder, of course, for any of us to know whether things are working. So I find that it's more the habits. I can see it in other people, in the habits that they take on in their day. Sometimes it'll be from the way they'll praise God for a perfect day when they get up. Usually if it's in a workplace, I can always tell a nurse who has a prosperity leaning by her sticky tabs on her monitor. Just like, everything is possible, exclamation mark, smiley face, hearts, hearts, hearts. And like, and it's because we all need that perpetual cycle of reminders. And so a lot of it is, and then of course in the way that they chit-chat. So the way that they correct each other. This always made me the absolute worst when I was doing the preamble before the service starts, where someone will say, like, and how are you? And the only answer is, like, blessed. And I'm like, I'll just always say something awkward, like, sorry, my hands are sweaty. And they're like, they're not sweaty in the Lord. So you're, like, always getting that correction. So, yeah, I find that because it's performed, they have a thousand small examples of how they achieved it. And so it makes, it eases the burden of waiting. It really does.
But so the victory is, the health and the wealth is in the perception, is in the eye of the beholder, but the victory is more of the group and of the church and of the leadership.
Yeah.
It's not your own, you don't get to victory, you get to health and wealth.
I mean, unless you're part of, you become, you get the amazing promotion and then you become sort of part of the super team in your church that's elevated as an example. So lots of times, remember.
And if you succeed in a measurable way, you're in the more special inner sanctum.
Yeah, that's right. And you're, and so that time that was normally used for prayer requests is very often a testimony time of someone who has a businessman who, it's so that we can all watch it and then believe that we can do it too.
Okay. Emma, we've come back around to you again.
Oh my gosh, already?
Yeah, one of your 10,000 questions.
Thank you.
And then I got Anne, and I got Adele on the list.
Okay, can I sneak in too? And they can be short if you want to give like little punctuation.
Yes, maybe. Yes.
So you've talked a little bit about the international footprint of the prosperity gospel and how this has really actually become bigger
than it is in the
United States. Yeah, it is. Am I close enough to the mic now?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So I'd love if you could just talk a little bit about trends and patterns you see overseas, and particularly for us with the reporter brain, what should we be following and looking for as prosperity gospel sort of expands overseas?
Sure.
And then in the domestic context, I'd love it if you could talk a little bit more about notions of femininity, masculinity, and sexuality that show up in prosperity gospel, how this deals with LGBT issues, women preachers, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What are the connections between those sort of themes and what you see in the United States?
Sure. You're going to have to remind me because that was world and...
World
all
and
sexual spectrum.
Sex gender.
I got it.
Yeah.
So world, interesting thing. I think it's a very kind of Philip Jenkins rise of global Christianity argument when you look at prosperity expressions move. So you'll see certain countries became kind of global seedbeds for their denomination, which is why the largest church in the Ukraine is run by a Nigerian named Pastor Sunday. And it's an expression of like Ukrainian folk dancing and then hardcore prosperity preaching. So I think what's important, what I would look for are big churches, hybrid cultural expressions. It's never usually like, and now the Swedes, even though the Swedes were super into it in the 80s. But people always surprise you. And mostly look for first generation immigrant churches growing, like the biggest ones in Toronto are all first generation. And then when they transition into second generation, then they usually move from hard to soft prosperity. And then watch how they assimilate. I find that stuff fascinating. But they're networked. This is never just going to be man with a plan. It's always going to be a network, and it's not hard to trace.
But they're in the millions.
Yeah, yeah, they really are. Or if they're not, they will tell you that they are. So it's hard to...
Kate, did you just say the Swedes?
Swedes were super into it, yeah. And they had a denomination called the Word of Life. And a single man, he eventually became a Catholic, so happy for the Catholics on that one, but... he's a Swedish guy, and he got really into Kenneth Hagin's teaching in the 70s, and he went back to Sweden. He's like, we're doing this. And then they were. And then, like, southern Norway, it was like they moved through a Norwegian Bible Belt. And, the 80s was a big moment for the prosperity gospel in Scandinavian countries. They asked me to come explain to them why, but my face was like, I got nothing. I don't know why. Because one of my theories is that it requires the specter of inequality to function largely. You don't have to be rich or poor. You just have to live within it. But the Swedes, man, like, it's got to be the most forcibly egalitarian culture in the world, right? So, but they're not into it anymore. The end.
Okay.
Sorry, hi, I'm a LGBT people. Yeah, hi. Okay.
And gender more broadly. So you
got it. Yeah. Because they come from Pentecostals, I'm much more comfortable with female leadership, but almost always a wife. Paula is very rare in that she survived a divorce, but she needed the presidential bump. She was reduced to TV. Did you say that, Elizabeth? She was on the way down before. And I've only seen gay prosperity preachers be ousted. I've never seen an open and affirming prosperity megachurch. So families is one of the primary expressions of the prosperity gospel. And so fertility, abundance, and like Christmas cards are one of the, I mean, that's the showpiece of how it works. So it does sort of, it makes them more sort of aggressively heterosexual. So in the new book, I ended up kind of tracking how they perform that. And part of it is hyperfemininity and hypermasculinity. So you can tell a prosperity preacher sometimes because he looks like a CrossFit instructor. And she is just like tucked into his arms, all willowy. So it's always, I mean, it's a faith you can see, right?
Yeah.
Adele Banks, you've been very patient. And then I have Ann and Sally. Pull the mic over, please.
I was wondering if you could reiterate the difference between hard and not so hard.
Prosperity gospel.
Hard and soft.
A couple of the key figures in each. And I also wondered if you could talk at all about the symbolism in the executive order National Day of Prayer ceremony in which Paula White was given one of the pens that was used to sign one of the orders. And she was just over the president's shoulder like the whole time during the ceremony. Just wonder about all that symbolism, what it meant to you. Thank you.
Hard and soft prosperity. So I used it as a spectrum to understand the relationship between them speaking and it coming into being. So how causal they thought their words were. So hard prosperity was immediate, supernatural, heavily instrumental. So hard prosperity preacher, like Charles Capps was a famous hard prosperity preacher, and he was used to be an Arkansas farmer. And he gave his famous example of how it works, that he laid out his mortgages, and he said, debt, be gone. I command unto you, finances, be restored. And so the way he preached was that he really believed there was a direct relationship between his speaking over and the dissolving of his debt. He never tells a story where he probably paid his bills, but it's a very immediatist. Charles Capps is a famous spreader of hard prosperity. Benny Hinn, I think Paula White's a hard prosperity preacher. Mike Murdoch, most of the more famous ones were hard prosperity. Soft prosperity has the same framework for cause and effect, but it's gradual, therapeutic, and largely less immediatist about how results can come about. You can get the money not just with a sudden infusion of cash, but with a gradual promotion. And I did not follow that nearly as carefully as the rest of you did, but it was the first time I've ever seen a prosperity preacher be publicly acknowledged and be the perching, overseeing eye rather than the person who they take the money from and never publicly acknowledge. Mm.
Ann Thompson, and Sally.
Kate, I listening to you describe the pastor's funeral, how do they in the prosperity gospel balance both healing and the notion of eternal life? Because
yes.
In most Christian traditions, that's the ultimate reward. And yet, they, at least from what you described, they seem to back away from it. So what role does eternal life play in the prosperity gospel?
Yeah, so I mean, they believe in heaven. This is not, this is imported into an entirely Christian salvation, like redemption and to eschatology, spiritual narrative arc. So yes, they absolutely believe in heaven and they think it will be wonderful. But what they do think, though, is people who rely on heaven as an excuse not to get theirs in the here and now are weak Christians. They are almost counterfeit. They have very harsh words about people who won't put into action the God-given faith that every believer has been, the luxury they've been afforded. So they think of it as a kind of spiritual laziness or a lack of expectation in the part of the people. They'll just call them traditional Christians. So they too believe in the beauty of heaven, and every now and then you'll get a glimpse of it in a funeral at the end. But for the most part, theirs is what we call a fully realized eschatology, which is the idea that the kingdom of God is almost fully present, whereas most Christians believe that you get glimpses of it, but it's the here and not yet.
Okay, can I be really blunt?
Yeah.
What is eschatology?
Oh, sorry, end times. Yeah, like, and not just, yeah, the end of time, the culmination of time. So it could be Jesus returning in a very exciting moment, or it could be the afterlife. Yeah.
And there are different views. There are at least three or four different views of eschatology.
But I think our other speaker was right that they don't really parse them that much. Their concern is that people, like Reverend Ike used to say, have your pie right now with the cherry on top. They really thought that it was more faithful to be looking in the here and now.
I really do wonder how much of that is a reaction to people of faith in marginalized communities constantly complaining about suffering and being told that things will be better in the afterlife.
Well, that's why, and I didn't want to like put too heavily on this, but the early people that combined the health and wealth message in the 20s, so a Father Divine,
right.
I don't want people to take away the idea that they invented the prosperity gospel, because I think what they did was they were doing what other Pentecostals were doing, which was applying that message of healing to other aspects of how about right now and not
right.
in the future. And it was an impatience. I mean, and the reason why they wore mink coats and some would even like keep their fingernails long to show their absence of a physical labor is to say it's also a pageantry of black beauty and dignity to say this is a body that is worth adorning rather than some symbol of excess and corruption. Mm. Yeah, so people really have to be careful about what money means to people.
Yeah. Sally and then Catherine.
I'm interested in the contrast of the prosperity gospel with other religion, other faiths. It does seem to me that, for instance, Christian Science has some similarities,
yes,
particularly with the whole idea of healing and faith. But I don't see any similarities between the prosperity gospel and Islam. I mean, if you look at the five pillars of Islam, one of them is the concern for the needy. That seems to be what people are concerned about. And in Judaism, I mean, one of my favorite songs is at Passover when people sing Dayenu, which is basically, even if we have only this, that would be enough. Hmm. And so I'm interested in your idea of
sure.
the differences where prosperity fits into these other faiths.
And could I just follow up on Sally's point to add to it? What do they have social ministries, soup kitchens, clothes drives? Is there a ministry of compassion that flows out of their own prosperity? If I could just add that to Sally's point.
Yes, almost all have some kind of outreach, though it ranges from very individualistic, like backpack giveaways kind of things, to, like I was mentioning, more in black denominational prosperity churches. They'll have more of the infrastructure around it, like housing and stuff.
Yeah.
So it falls along a range. Almost all of them will have some kind of charity outreach, and they use that as armor to say that we are not self-aggrandizing. So they have two justifications for their wealth. One, I have it to show you that you can do it too, and two, look at all my charities. I think the part that would be most familiar to other religious traditions is the idea of works righteousness. Luther put a bad spin on it, but really just the idea that spiritual labor is valuable to God in acts of charity, in some kind of, as Hinduism teaches a kind of reciprocal relationship between your efforts and then your next life.
I forgot to mention the Sikhs, who are very much into taking care of others and feeding.
So they would say they take care of everyone, thank you very much. They're quite defensive on that point. But I think you're right. In terms of a sense, though, that that acts of charity and giving unto others is, more valuable to God than self-aggrandizement. So I, as an American religious historian who mostly just does Christianity, I run pretty thin on other traditions. But I will say that in all of the thousands of letters I got from people, I thought people's religious traditions was a very interesting barometer in how they reacted to my suffering. A lot of the lovely Jewish letters I got were like, oh, totally suffering, I get it. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry people are so mean to you about the suffering. But then a lot of Hindu letters, which were like, you maybe need to do some digging. On why. And then some lovely Buddhists who are like, let me take on practices so that you might transfer some of your suffering to me and that we might share it. Oh, that was kind of beautiful. Mm. So, but it fell along a spectrum of people's ability to tolerate ambiguity around suffering. And prosperity is the most intolerant of broken bodies.
Okay, Catherine. And then Michelle.
So thank you so much for this talk and for this book, which I taught recently in my survey course, and I just thought it was such a wonderful model for my students of how to approach movements that you might disagree with in a spirit of empathy and trying to understand before rushing to judgment. So I really appreciate that. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the relationship between the prosperity gospel and capitalism, because listening to you talk this morning, and you invoked briefly Max Weber, it sounds to me in some ways as if the prosperity gospel is creating the kind of ideal economic self for a capitalist marketplace. The discipline, the strenuousness of selfhood in this tradition is remarkable. And then it seems as if there's always a kind of easy answer for economic inequality. Yeah. So if you would just reflect a little bit more, I mean, I assume that there are points of resistance here, that this isn't just kind of a mirror of a capitalist culture. And so I'm wondering if there's anything other than a lack of faith, any demonic forces that prevent people from accumulating wealth. And then I wondered if you would just say something briefly. I want to give you the opportunity to do this. A few years ago, there was some press about whether prosperity preachings were responsible for the subprime mortgage crisis. So I would love to hear your thoughts about that.
Right. Is this making the most effective? Is this just Christian neoliberalism? Yes, totally. But also, I think so this is partly what I struggled with when I was trying to understand their view of the economy, because I couldn't figure out if they believed it was entirely real. You know, what I mean by that is that they believed that they were participating in kind of a closed spiritual universe in which everything, all effort is redeemable for rewards. So they had a sense of that, their own divine economy, and that it was somehow linked to the markets. Sometimes, insofar as they would receive rewards usually through some kind of good capitalism. But so often what I found was in their usually very heavily metaphorical language, it was hard to tell whether it was a real economy or what the God was ultimately the God of the market and beyond, and could make these sort of supernatural interventions. So the end times wealth transfer stuff I thought was a very impressive intervention into that by trying to say, look, Wall Street might entirely be against each and every one of us and be satanic, and yet still we will be remunerated. And so I was never quite sure how literal this language was and how bound they were to the neoliberalism that they seemed to reflect. I felt like I just wanted more economist friends to help me. But yeah, I think they have not just easy answers, but they have protests. Like, they won't work on Sunday. In fact, they spend most of their time at church. And so that is also an anti-capitalist. They're not skipping out on their spiritual responsibilities. They're assuming that if they give God the best, the first fruits that Paul loves so much, that God will reward them regardless. And so they spend more time in church, that ethnographic community I was with, than anyone I've ever known, expecting that that matters more to God than their time at work. So they're not quite, you're right, as good capitalists as they may seem.
So their services are long.
Oh, they are a million years. I remember one time, like 2 hours into a service, I heard the the chilling words, "Does anyone have any more announcements?" And I realized the sermon hadn't started. I was like, no. So, yeah, that's part of that spiritual tarrying. There's some interesting studies about, like, the suicide rates. This sounds bad when I start it, but the suicide rates and the lengths of services, I think it was among Black Pentecostal communities, and it was something along your point of, like, that the time and, like, the just sort of spiritual saturation was creating, like, psychological resistance against the grind of a system that did not value them, and that there was something about, like, the tearing in that space that was actually created a great deal of resilience. So I think there's something there.
Michelle's going to have the last question.
Does not necessarily facilitate financial scandal, or maybe, I'm probably the only one I know who bought one of those bad mortgages. not them. Yeah.
What is the music like in these churches?
Well, it really ranges in more Pentecostal churches. Well, everyone has Hillsong. Everyone loves Hillsong. But it's it really just depends. It follows more the tradition that it springs out of. So it might be gospel, black gospel. It might be evangelical praise bands.
Yeah.
But it's almost always intense in an exciting way. I really enjoy it.
And goes on and on and on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the really fancy ones, like the Joel Osteen, like they have like a million services they need to get out. So that's only going to take 25 minutes, a lead, a crescendo, two waterfalls, and some Holy Spirit fogging. So it's pretty like on point. And, yeah.
Michelle Cottle, you'll take us into lunch.
All right. Well, I hate to close on the granular, but I'm completely intrigued by, back to the whole quantification of, yes, acting your faith. So, like, how literal are you talking here? I mean, are they taught to write down, you know, every time you smile at your boss, every time you do this? And is it mostly the acting of the faith, or is it also quantifying the returns they're getting? Like, I got a bonus this week.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
you know, do they then need to share that with the congregations? So, kind of first, how literal are we talking here? I mean, it's like the quants have taken over religion on some level.
Yeah, well, I think they're mostly taught to pay attention, and then some of them habituate it into their lives. There are certain things I think they do keep track of scripture memorization, and then ability to use it. They'll still count. I mean, evangelism is really a huge part of this gospel, so they do count the number of people they talk to in a day. You know, I'm always on the receiving end of that, so I'm sure they're keeping track. So I think it's more like a series of patterns that the most righteous then take on. And then churches become the primary showpieces of that. That's the place where you describe all the things you did that week that made a difference. And then you teach each other to count.
So that's part of the service, is the sharing of
If you're in a small church, big churches will never let people talk unscripted. But small churches, absolutely. That's the prayer and that's the testimony section. The spiritual humble bragging part of the week.
You know, I've learned something really important here, and that is if I smile at my colleague Sylvia, I'll get a bonus once a week. And I just can't wait to see how that works out. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking Kate for this wonderful